Now, I'm sorry, I'm not going to stand here and give you all sorts of wonderful alternatives because I just got back from Doha, Qatar last night. And I actually, if with your indulgence, I'd rather tell you what happened at the WTO over the last week. Is that okay? Which is not unhopeful. It's bloody awful, but not unhopeful at all. But there is some bad news, and then I'll get to the good news after. Well, coming out of that, I don't know whether we launched a round or not. Probably those of you watching the website can watch the debate about was it a new round or wasn't it. Nobody seems to know, not the WTO, none of the countries that signed. It's all a great mystery. I want to talk to you about basically three things that really concerned me about what happened there. The first was the extreme marginalization of our movement. First of all, they chose a place. Qatar is a desert, small desert, like a peninsula that into the Arabian Sea, right by the United Arab Emirates. And they have a lot of money from oil, and so they plunked down a huge, very modern city right smack on the ocean, and they built a whole bunch of very gorgeous, I guess, I thought, although I thought they were all soulless and awful, but a lot of resorts. And the one that we were in was the Sheraton, which was built in the shape of a pyramid and all gold encrusted. I mean, you've never seen anything as opulent in your life. In fact, they called it a five-star hotel, but that's only because that's as many stars as are recognized. This would easily be in your 10-star category if they had such things. And, of course, they chose a country that, well, the people were very nice to us, does not allow any protest whatsoever. There's a journalist in prison with no end in sight in his prison term for just having criticized some, in a very mild way, some policies of the government. And they put us all in this compound which had three levels. Talk about your perimeters. They didn't need any fences there. This is a place where you just simply don't speak back. And so they had the three levels of perimeters. To get into the inner perimeter was you had to go down streets that were lined with men with guns and the white robes, of course, with great big, I don't know, Kalashnikovs or whatever they are, great big guns. And you just didn't dare turn around. When you went into your hotel, and we were all booked, nobody said where we were. The delegates were all put in very fancy hotels. The developing delegates were put in less nice hotels. The NGOs were put in dumps. It didn't matter where we were put. There were security forces. When we got into the hotel, you had to go through security. The security knew when you were coming and going. I mean, you just never were not accounted for the entire time. It reminded me when I went to Iraq on the eve of the Gulf War 10 years ago on an international women's peace mission, and I had a minder the whole time I was there, and her name was Mina, and of course I called her Mina the Minder. And I would go up to bed at night in my hotel, and Mina would be at the door waving me goodnight, and the first thing that I came down in the morning, there would be Mina, all bright and shining, and she would just know somehow exactly when I was getting out of that elevator. Well, I mean, it was that kind of control. As well, the WTO set out to limit us. They only reserved just over 600 spots for so-called NGOs, but they consider the Business Council on National Issues to be an NGO. And so over 400 of the designated NGOs were actually business lobby groups. So that left about just under 200 spots from the entire world to represent our movement. And of course, it's extremely expensive to get there, and it's extremely expensive to stay there, and it's extremely expensive to eat food there. In fact, there was a real class system happening in that compound. The luncheon buffet was about $70 American, and I'm not making that up. It was people who just couldn't. They kept saying, no, we must be misunderstanding. So there were just awful sandwiches you could get for a lot of money. It came to about $12.50 for sandwich and a glass of juice, American. And that's what we all lived on for the good part of the time. And as I say, the NGOs were put in the worst accommodation, as far away from the site as we could possibly get. And then, of course, they also had us in an NGO center, which was a good 15-minute walk from the main center. So although we were full delegates in the sense that we were allowed to come in and observe, they kept us over there. And then when the negotiations started, they just sealed off the halls, and we weren't allowed to go anywhere near the negotiators, nor was the press. So this was an absolute control of us and our movement, and it was just an atrocious, appalling, an aggressive violation of our civil rights and our freedom to speak. I will say, however, that we did as much as we could with the bad situation, including the first night we all said to each other, what do? We have the guts to do this? And without any notification, we went as the opening ceremony was beginning and came in with tape over our mouths and signs that we held up saying that, our voices had been silenced. And we were told later, then that went from protest to protest, and we had wonderful stuff all week, and we spoke to the media, not much Canadian media and not much American media, but we did speak to the media of the developing world a lot through their press. And we were told by the security forces, well, we understand that this is just part of the WTO and that we have to put up with you this week, but were you to do any of this, even the free speech part of this, even the criticism part of this, the day after the WTO leaves town, you'd be in prison. So, I mean, that was the atmosphere in which we held our protests in Qatar. The second thing that was just dreadfully disturbing was the abusive treatment of the delegations and the countries of the South. First of all, they came in with a draft text which had not been approved by everyone. This is a mistake. You see, I want to tell you what they're doing now and how controlled this is. The mistake, one of the mistakes they made in Seattle was that they came in with what's called a bracketed text, and that's a text in which you show everybody's disagreements. Well, everybody felt good that their disagreements were there, so they all, started off with the position that there were different positions. This time, Michael Moore and what they call the Quad, Canada, the U.S., the European Union, and Japan, set out the agenda, put it down, a very aggressive new agenda with new items, particularly competition and investment, government procurement, and so on, all of which is deeply opposed by the southern governments and the southern delegates, and they just put it into a text with no brackets. There was a huge fight in Geneva the last time they met before coming to Qatar, but Michael Moore said it was too late to change anything. We'll all go to Qatar and we'll fight it out there. So at the opening, while we were outside with the tape over our mouths protesting, they actually tabled the draft text as being from the committee to the committee of the whole, it's called, and with no mention of the fact that there was a disagreement from about 90% of the delegates and the countries sitting in that room. So it started off on an appalling basis. They had what they call, you've probably heard the term green room, which is where the powerful countries, well, Michael Moore, the director general, was set up what he calls friends of the chair. Canada is always the best friend of the chair. And then they go out and they put small groups of dissenting third world countries in a room and don't give them any coffee or water or food or sleep and just pummel them down until they agree. Well, this time that did not facilitators. And we called them green men, and we had a great action around green men. It was great fun. We had José Bové playing Pascal Lamy, who's the European trade representative. And he was so good that I actually hated him for a few minutes. He really got into it, right? But they would send this facilitator back and forth between the different delegations, and they would get them fighting each other, and they actually would lie to them and get them set up against each other, and then the facilitator would go back to the chair, and Canada's case, Pierre Pettigrew, our trade minister, was the chair of the new issues, so that's the MAI, investment and so on, coming back. And he would then just decide what he wanted to hear and what he just didn't think he needed to hear. That was just appalling and abusive. And as well, there was just dirty deal-making going on in the back rooms. You could tell, speaking of the connection to this, the World Bank was busy forgiving loans and the IMF forgiving loans and giving out little treaties here and there. And there were last-minute deals about opening up, a certain textile market in the United States. And there's one lovely case where they promised Pakistan to open up a certain kind of textile market, a certain particular subsector of the textile market, which Pakistan had won through a trade agreement 2 years ago, and said, you just can't possibly imagine that you can insult us that much, that you're saying you're going to give it to us here when we won it through the rules you set 2 years ago, right? It was just, it was awful. And what happened was that the developing country delegates, one after another, caved. I mean, we just watched this happen. At one point, we really did think that there was going to be a chance that there would be walkout. And I have to tell you, India was strong and brave to the end. It was very, very difficult for India to stand up all by itself. So the third real concern to you then is that an agenda that 90% of the world's countries, and I would argue 90% of the world's people, if they knew what was in them, nevertheless was launched. Full go-ahead on the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services. In fact, I hate to tell you, it wasn't even debated there. Every single country has just bought into the GATS. In the third world, it's because they were long ago forced to give up their social programs through structural adjustment, which is why we're all here tonight with the World Bank and the IMF. And with countries like Canada, I mean, Canada has bought into this, not just bought into it, Canada is an absolute leader in promoting services agenda. So there was absolutely no debate. The MAI is back. They managed to put investment on the agenda. Now, there's still a dispute, even after the agreement was signed or everybody gave its okay, as to what happened at the end. Because what would happen was people would fight all day, and then the negotiators would go away at night, or the WTO secretariat, and they would rewrite a new draft for the next morning, and then people would fight about the new draft the next morning. And so what happened on the investment issue is that for the last draft on the last day, they finally agreed, okay, we can't launch it here. It was clear that wasn't going to happen. India and a bunch of other countries were going to walk. So they said, what we'll do is we'll plan to launch it in the next ministerial in 2 years. But what we'll do now is we'll set up working groups but they'll have to have consensus on what they call modalities. Now, believe me, this sounds really arcane, but these words matter, because the question was, were they setting up a consensus program, a process on the modalities, which just means the methods of how they're going to negotiate, or was it were they going to have agreement itself in the next ministerial? And right to the last moment that evening, India, when they held the committee of the whole and the full final plenary, no one was sure what India was going to do. And India finally interpreted their letter of understanding with the WTO secretariat as nothing's on the table until we get to the next ministerial, which means that we now have, we'd have 2 years to work on this. Well, I see from reading my emails today that the United States doesn't read it that way, and Japan doesn't read it that way, and Canada doesn't read it that way, so we may have no agreement at all. On top of which, the United States has not ratified Fast Track Authority, so they didn't even, Robert Zoellick, the U.S. trade rep, didn't even have the authority to be bargaining away the kinds of things that he was doing when he was there. And the most terrible thing that happened of all was this. Europe was vying, pushing for these new issues. This should be called the Europe Round. It should be called the Power Round or the Europe Round. But anyway, Europe was pushing very hard. On the last night, during the night, when they were doing all this work, Europe had said it was going to give on this investment in competition, these new issues. They would give in on waiting 2 years if they could put something on the environment on the table. And this is how they've sold it back home in Europe. We got something on the environment. So they wrote a clause which was adopted the next day, and I swear to you, I went around to delegates saying, did you see this? Do you know what this is? Gee, no, I never noticed it, because I'm exhausted, and B, this wasn't a bone of contention. This is where all our attention was. I swear to you, I don't think anybody noticed it. And it is absolutely awful. What it says is that it starts off sounding okay. The WTO will have to start working with and towards a recognition of compatibility with what are MEAs, multilateral environment agreements. But then it says, but any country that hasn't signed an MEA doesn't apply to. Well, which country comes to mind right away? United States, not signing Kyoto, not signing the biosafety protocol, and so on. But more importantly, this would pit WTO against environment agreements in the future, meaning, what country would ever sign an environmental agreement? And then it goes on to say that while they don't prejudice the outcome, it has to be within the current rules of the agreement, including the SPS, the Sanitary and Phytosanitary Agreement, which is the agreement that tells you what you can and what governments can and can't do to protect the health and food safety and health conditions and plants and so on of their people. I mean, this is just outrage. But the biggest outrage is still to come. They put another statement in. It's called 31.3, III. And 31III says that, bang, out of nowhere, nobody had been talking about this, that they've now agreed to eliminate Canada, all of the countries of the WTO have agreed there's no discussion about this, no bracket. We've agreed to eliminate tariff and non-tariff barriers on environmental services. Now, you know, tariffs are taxes on imports, so we can't have, you know, talk about that in terms of water. You couldn't have a two-price system, but non-tariff barriers are all of the regulations and standards that corporations don't want to bump into when they go across borders. Environmental services, you have to go back to the old GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, and that's where you find that it includes water, wastewater, hazardous waste disposal, toxic waste disposal, incinerators, nuclear waste. I mean, everything that we need the highest standards in the world for. Is now been put in the WTO, aside from the services agreement. That'll be in the services agreement too, but that hasn't even been negotiated yet. This is in the current body in a separate section, supposedly for the environment, under a section called trade and environment. This is absolutely clearly going to lead to the privatization of our water, to the corporate control of all of the environmental safety standards and safety processes and, quote, services around the world. And it will bring those areas under the same jurisdiction that has basically knocked down environmental rules, has stopped governments and countries from increasing labor standards and human rights standards. This was the dirtiest thing I have ever seen in my life. And I honestly don't believe most of the delegates even saw it. In fact, I accosted Sergio Marchi, Canada's trade minister, and our trade ambassador, used to be our trade minister, and I said, "Have you seen this?" Now, in fairness, he looked like somebody beating him up. They hadn't slept for days. He looked down at it, and he looked at me, and I could see, you haven't seen this. You haven't seen this. And I said, "Do you know what this means?" And this means our water. And he said, "It doesn't mean that, and it can't mean that. It doesn't mean that." I mean, he hadn't seen it before. And he turned around and walked away, and he went into the plenary where they voted to ratify this. So that was the story, and I think that what we saw in Doha, Qatar, was that they learned their lesson in Seattle. They don't like democracy. It's extraordinarily messy. It broke out. It kicked them, and it stopped the process, and they're not going to let that happen again. And I think you're going to find that places like Doha, Qatar, are going to be the venue of choice for institutions like the World Bank, the WTO, Asia Development Bank, just held its recent meeting in Honolulu because they have the American Air Base there. It's too damned expensive for anyone to get there in large numbers. You know, it made a difference being there and not having you guys there. You know, when we'd say, you know, civil society says we didn't have 40, 50, 60, 80,000 people out in the street saying, "Yeah, that's right." There was no sound of this. It was the sound of one hand clapping, and it was as they chose to do. And it was when I saw people coming up to be photographed with Jose Bove, I'm talking about delegates and senior ministers, being photographed with the mascot from our side, that I thought, this is just disgraceful. This is just terrible. This proves, you know, when they say, just as Antonia said in her excellent presentation, that, you know, they argue now that poverty, that globalization will reduce poverty. They also argue that globalization will improve human rights. They haven't the least bit interest in improving human rights. What could be better than a country that has the heir apparent chosen, you know, each generation away, where you're not allowed any protest whatsoever? What could be better? And I'll tell you a little funny story about that. We held another NGO briefing with Michael Moore, the director general. We'd done this in Seattle, and he was appallingly arrogant, and he has learned nothing. He was as appallingly arrogant again this time, again saying that if Martin Luther King were alive, he would, and Gandhi were alive, they would be there on his side. And there was a moderator from the WTO, and then a young Qatari man dressed in the white garb sitting on the other side. So everybody was really intensely involved in this debate with Michael Moore. Then he suddenly had to leave. And so the WTO official said, "Now we have some arrangements. Anything you want to ask about arrangements?" Well, of course, we're all tired, we're cranky, and we just had a fight with Michael Moore, and we think this guy's a low-level bureaucrat who's going to tell us about buses. In fact, he does start to say about buses, and he's not speaking very loudly, so we all say, "Speak up." Anyway, it turns out he was the Crown Prince. So when we found out he was the Crown Prince, Walden Beldo got up and asked if we were going to be allowed to demonstrate, and he said yes, and that was all those guards needed that week, was that he had said yes, we all knew within what parameters, but that was very interesting. So what is our job now, vis-a-vis, obviously, here with the IMF and the World Bank and the G8 coming to Canada and? Our job, as I see it, is three things. First of all, and I'm mostly talking here WTO, but of course this expands to all of the work that we're doing. First of all, we have to keep our movement strong. This is a really hard time. Post-September 11th is going to be very hard on all of us. And there's heightened fear out there. There's heightened sensitivity. The right wing has taken the opportunity to take the gloves off and to say things that they would never have the nerve to say under any other circumstance. When any of us speak out in any kind of dissent, they call us names they wouldn't have dared call us before September 11th. These are going to be times that are going to be very hard. We're going to see, we are witnessing the criminalization of dissent. We have anti-terrorist bills in the United States, Canada, and Great Britain that are destroying our civil liberties. And I think if I were a terrorist, what a nice thing it would be to watch that happen. Wouldn't I think that that was so interesting that I could undo years and years and years of fights for democracy and civil rights in such a way? So this is going to be a very hard time for our movement. And you know what? This is when we're most needed, and this is when we most need to stick together, and this is when we most need to trust each other, and this is when we most need to stay strong. It's easy to be a movement when you're winning. It was amazingly powerful in Seattle, and we all were there, and we all know that. If we weren't there physically, we were there in our heads and our hearts. It's going to be harder now, and it's going to be especially harder since they've decided that they've found the way to stop us from expressing ourselves in institutions, at institutional meetings like the WTO. But I'll tell you, I came home, you'll enjoy this story, I went and came home on the government plane because we were all a little nervous about security. And also I thought if the southern countries walk out quickly, I don't want to be stuck there with a plane ticket and have to stick around for 5 days. Also, if it goes longer, I'll want to come home when the Canadian delegation comes home. And there's so many chickens, including Tom DeKino, the head of the Business Council on National Issues, who just got the flu or whatever at the last minute because they were too scared to go there. So there were lots of spaces on the plane, and they offered them to us. We paid for them. I don't want you to think I took a free ride from the government. So I went over and came back on the same plane as all the bad guys, all the senior Department of Foreign Affairs international trade people, all the corporate lobby groups, Pierre Pettigrew and Sergio Marchi. And I can tell you, coming home on the way home, first of all, they slept. It's a 20-hour trip, but they slept, and then they woke up, and then they started to drink, and then they started the high fives. And I sat there, and I thought, to Pierre Pettigrew, I'm the worm in your apple. I'm the worm in your apple. I was there. I saw what you did. I saw what you were part of, and you guys are worms too. You hear me? We're the worm in their apple, and they will not get away with what they did there. We were there. Secondly, we have to form deeper ties with the South. We have done so much work in this area in the last few years. And I know Halifax Initiative and so many of the people and the groups in this room have been working in this area for a long time. This has to be a priority. We have to be there and be supportive. We have to work as a team. We have to learn from them. We have to deepen those ties. One of the things that I saw in Qatar, and I had seen it in Geneva the year before when a number of us from around the world got together in an anti-GATS international meeting and we met with developing country delegates, what struck me, and this is going to be hard for us to understand, as these countries, some of these less developed countries, so-called, get more power, they're going to buy into the game. And one day, we're going to be building a movement of North and South civil society against North and South governments. I am absolutely convinced of it. South Africa, Nelson Mandela's South Africa was as bad as Canada there. Played an awful role, a totally, completely liberalizing role. As countries buy into this, we're going to find, I don't think it's going to be as easy a thing as we wanted to think, that it's NGOs in the north, civil society groups in the north, with civil society groups in the south, with their delegates and with their negotiators. Yes, there are some who were brave and stood strong, and I believe there were some who lost their careers because they took a position there. But the reality is that, and I've said this, you know, many times, that it seems that when people become trade ministers, it's like they've been genetically altered and they just take the line. It doesn't matter where they're from, what their background is, governments start to buy into this stuff. And I'll tell you, one of the reasons is that the negotiators who went to Doha from the third world represent their class and not their country. And that is something we need to understand. There's a class reality here. There's a third world in the first world. There's a first world in the third world. And the first world of the third and first world have found each other. They are a new global royalty, and they know exactly what they are doing. A lot of those southern countries were only holding out to get deals. And we need to understand that. This is very, very difficult to say and watch. And we need to deepen our ties with our colleagues and allies from the south. And the last thing I want to say is that we have to deal with these new items. We have to rebuild this MAI coalition. We have got to stop this. What happened there, and for those of us who live in North America or the American hemisphere, North and South America, we've got the FTAA on one side, which combines services and investment. And we now have the WTO with services and investment coming up, starting the process now to be launched in 2 years, and with this dangerous new provision around the environment, which takes us 10 steps backward, steadily, strongly backward. We have got to work together to stop these, and that has got to be part of our international movement. Just want to leave you, since my friend Mike Moore talked about Martin Luther King, I'll leave you with some words by Martin Luther King. He said, "Cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but one must take it because it is right." That's what we're doing here tonight. Thank you.
That was Maude Barlow, chairperson of the Council of Canadians. For more info on Maude Barlow's work, you can visit the Council of Canadians website at www.canadians.org. Tonight's program concludes with a presentation by Professor Alex Kalinikos, a political scientist from the University of York in the UK. The talk we're about to hear was given slightly over a year ago in Prague as part of the educational activities surrounding the protests there against the meeting of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, which also met earlier this month in Canada.
I'm very happy to be here in Prague speaking under the auspices of INPEG. As others have said, this is a very important moment in the development of what I think is a global anti-capitalist movement. But some people think that they were pretty irrelevant. I don't know if any of you have read this week's Newsweek. The cover says, "Join the party. IMF, World Bank, globalization's biggest fans, the young capitalists of Eastern Europe." And inside there are stories about people, the very few young people who are benefiting from the new type of private capitalism in Eastern and Central Europe, and how they love the IMF and so on. And the article also pours a great deal of scorn on the protesters here in Prague. Well, I have one question to ask. If globalization is so great, why do the Czech authorities feel obliged to ban the march on September the 26th? If everyone is happy with what's happening in the Czech Republic, why is it that the Czech authorities are blocking protesters from coming into the country at the borders? If everything is so wonderful with globalization, why are they so afraid of us? And the answer is very simple. Not many people are joining their party. Not many people are happy with the way in which the world is going economically. and socially and morally and culturally. And that's why the current anti-capitalist movement is developing so powerfully. I don't want to repeat any of the very powerful analysis that Walden Bellow put forward before the break. He gave a very good analysis of the kind of reasons, the kind of effects of global capitalism which are leading to the development of this movement, which has led to the demonstrations at Seattle, Davos, Washington, Mio, Melbourne, and next week Prague as well, just in the space of the last year. I don't want to go over that ground, but what I want to do is to try and help clarify what we're about, what we're trying to do in this movement. Because I agree with Walden Bellow that a number of major issues are coming up as the movement develops, and we need a dialogue and a debate to try and clarify what it is that we're trying to do. And therefore, I hope it doesn't sound too pretentious, I want to put forward what I call 9 anti-capitalist theses. 9 theses which I hope are relevant to politically defining the character of the anti-capitalist movement that is developing around the world. And the first of these theses is that the enemy is not globalization as such, but global capitalism. You see, all the time, the defenders of the IMF, the World Bank, the Washington Consensus say these people are against globalization. They're against links between people in different countries. They're for narrow, nationalist, parochial, protectionist policies. What I say to them is that the real people in the world who are trying to divide us along narrow nationalist lines are the current rulers of the world, who are deeply embroiled with the IMF, the World Bank, and the rest of it. Campaigners, anti-capitalist campaigners, are not the people who are persecuting asylum seekers and refugees around the world. It's not the anti-capitalist campaigners who go around attacking so-called economic migrants, in other words, victims of global capitalism, who are driven to move from their own country to other countries. We're not the people who are against greater links between people in different parts of the world. We want to see let me put it like this. One respect in which I disagreed with what Walden said was when he quoted a British neoconservative called John Gray, who was talking about the need to defend local and national cultures against globalization. Sometimes conservatives can attack capitalism because it undermines traditional institutions which they have a vested interest in. But the fact they attack capitalism doesn't mean that we can simply agree with them. I think that part of what we should be trying to do is, yes, defend what's valuable in traditional cultures at the national and local level, but at the same time seeking to build a genuinely international community. The existing international community is an obscene joke, a myth, a lie, seeking to build a genuine international community and developing a genuine international culture which reflects and celebrates the diversity that exists in the world today. So that the enemy is not globalization, it's global capitalism. It's the economic system under which we live, driven by the priorities of profit. Now, the second point I want to make is that these theses I want to put forward is that the core institutions of global capitalism are the multinational corporations, the leading capitalist states, particularly the G7 states, and the international institutions that reflect their interests. And clearly, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the European Union, also, let's not forget NATO as well, are key institutions that sustain and defend the interests of these global capitalist forces. I think it's important to mention NATO because because global capitalism doesn't simply operate economically, it also operates militarily. It needs, if you like, its debt collection agency. It needs the ability to use its military power to maintain its control over the world, as we saw with the Balkan War last year. And I think that I agree with those who've already spoken today who say that institutions like the IMF, the WTO, the World Bank cannot be reformed. What we have to do is to mobilise the forces that can break these institutions. The third thesis that I want to put forward involves drawing on who I think was not the first anti-capitalist by any means, but who is still the greatest anti-capitalist, namely Karl Marx. Because you see, we need to have a clear understanding of the nature of what we're fighting. And the most visible form of what we're fighting are these institutions and the multinational corporations. But it's a mistake too much to try and physically embody the enemy. In an earlier session, there was a discussion about what's the best metaphor for talking about global capitalism or globalization, whatever, and there was the suggestion that it's a virus. I think the best way of thinking about... let me make this clear. I think that very often, when people think about the multinationals and the IMF and so on and so forth, they think of it a bit like the Borg in Star Trek. I apologise, I'm sufficiently influenced by Americanized, globalized culture to watch Star Trek. And if you've ever seen Star Trek, you'll know that they're these terrible aliens, the Borg, who conquer and assimilate other planets and galaxies and so on all the time. And they're very sinister and frightening and so on and so forth. I think that's how many people in the anti-capitalist movement see the multinationals and the rest of them, like this monstrous alien entity which seeks to assimilate and destroy. And of course, that's a critical dimension to how the multinationals and the rest of them operate. They do seek to assimilate and destroy. But in doing that, they reflect the logic of the system of which they are the part. And this takes me to the third thesis that I want to put forward, which comes from Marx, which is the idea that capital, as he put it, is not a thing but a relation. Capital, in other words, global capitalism isn't simply a set of specific institutions. It's a system that operates according to a certain logic that drives all the entities that make up that system. The logic of this system is competitive accumulation. The endless competitive struggle among rival capitalist institutions, firms, and the rest to extract for themselves as large a possible profit out of ourselves and out of the planet. Each individual unit of the system, like a multinational corporation, is caught up in this logic. It is dominated by the logic. Even the most powerful multinational corporations, like Microsoft or General Motors or any of the others, do not control the environment, the set of relationships of which they are part. They are prisoners of they too are prisoners of the system from which they profit. They're very privileged prisoners, but they are still caught up in this logic which they cannot fully control. And that means that the problem isn't simply a matter of policy or the individuals that run particular firms or the international institutions. It isn't even a problem. The problem lies deeper even than the institutions themselves, like the IMF. They lie in the system itself and the logic of accumulation that drives it. This then leads to a fourth thesis that I want to put forward, which is that the requirements of capitalist reproduction set limits to the regulation and reform of the system. Again, in the history of capitalism, there have been efforts to civilize it, efforts to impose restraints on it, to make it more amenable to the needs of the people of the particular parts of the world or of the world as a whole. The most important attempt in the 20th century was the efforts by social democratic parties in the North, in Europe and North America, to create what has come to be known as the Keynesian welfare state. And in many respects, this did represent a more humane and decent version of capitalism as a system. What we've seen in the last generation is the basic logic of capitalism, of competitive accumulation reasserting itself and sweeping away most of the restraints that were built up in the middle of the 20th century and made it a somewhat more civilized system. And it's important to understand that historical experience because it allows us to understand the limits of seeking to reform global capitalism. Of course, it's very important to fight for reforms to make that system a bit more decent and a bit more humane, a bit more accommodating for the people who live under it than it is at the present time. However, we have to understand that any reform that we achieve is likely to be fragile, under threat, subject to counterattack, subject to assault, and perhaps subject to destruction, as we've seen in the last generation, should whatever those reforms may be, turn out to be a restraint to the effective expansion of the system. The logic of the system and the requirements of its reproduction, the requirements of profitable accumulation, set limits to our ability to reform it. That's the essential point that I want to make. Often we see individual politicians... No, I'm sorry. Often is putting it too strongly. Occasionally we see politicians who make a genuine attempt to try and make the system a bit more reform. More decent. Oscar Lafontaine, who was finance minister in the Red-Green coalition in Germany at the end of 1998, the beginning of 1999, did, I think, make quite a sincere attempt to introduce quite modest reforms, to make central banks a bit democratically accountable, to make the rich pay a little more taxes and the poor make a little less. He was driven from office by a campaign mounted by the leading German businesses, who told Schröder, the German Chancellor, if Lafontaine wasn't removed, they would start moving their businesses out of Germany. This is a reflection of the... In many ways, it's a modest reflection. There are much more brutal examples around the world. For example, the destruction of the Allende government in Chile in 1973. This is a reflection, indication of the kind of forces that capital will mobilise against any serious attempt to restrain and to reform it. The fifth thesis I want to put forward is this. One implication of the fact that capital is a relation, not a thing, is that capital, globalised capitalism, is fundamentally dependent on its opposite, on wage labour. The big corporations don't make their profits just through some kind of magic or through their own cleverness. They try and make us think that, and all the propaganda these days about e-commerce and dot-com companies and the internet economy and so on and so forth are intended to suggest that there's some magical process through which companies make profits. This is not true. Now, as always in the history of capitalism makes its... Capital derives its profits from the exploitation of wage labour, of now hundreds of millions of human beings caught up in the capitalist labour market throughout the world, south and north, who labour in plantations, in factories, in mines, in hospitals, in offices, in all sorts of different kinds of workplaces in order to produce the profits on which the system depends. Now, this is, of course, a very old and basic Marxist insight. But it's a very important insight to keep hold of because in the last generation, as capitalism has become more rampant, more powerful, more brutal, it's easy, as I said earlier, to have the kind of Borg image of capitalism as all-powerful, as incapable of being defeated. But the fact that capital still depends upon the exploitation of wage labour means that capital is not all-powerful, that it's liable to paralysing challenges from the workers on which the system depends. And when workers get it together to mount effective collective action, to go on strike. They can bring that system to a halt. This remains as true now as it ever has in the history of capitalism. Look at France. Look at the way in which France has been transformed over the last 5 or 6 years, from a society which in the early 1990s was dominated by the politics of the neoliberal right. Racism was on the advance, the left was fragmented and demoralised, to a situation today where France is now one of the international centres of the anti-capitalist movement. What has brought about that transformation? Well, the mass public sector strikes of November-December 1995, the way in which they broke the neoliberal programme of the government, the so-called Juppé plan, and didn't simply defeat that government, but created a climate in which now, it's true, a Socialist Party government tries to implement the same sorts of neoliberal measures, but now in a climate where there's mass resistance and constant pressure on the government which forces it to accommodate its policies. This then leads me to a sixth thesis, which is that the relationship between organised labour and other social movements is in the process of being redefined. You see, over the last generation, there's been a very strong belief that the organised labour, crucially the trade unions, operates on a completely different social and political track from what are sometimes called the new social movements, the movements that have developed around women's liberation, against racism, in defence of the environment, over a number of other issues. They have been seen as completely different and separate movements. Now, I think that we're at a stage where that is beginning to break down. This, for me, is the historic importance, more than anything else, of Seattle. It wasn't just that the protesters stopped Seattle. Who were the protesters? On the one hand, they were the people mobilised by the NGOs on different third world causes, environmental causes. On the other hand, they were some of the central battalions of organised labour in the United States. Machinists, teamsters, auto workers, steel workers, longshoremen. And remember, the American trade union movement doesn't exactly have a history of progressive politics. It has a history of often following behind the parties of big business, like the Democrats and the Republicans. It is a history on economic issues of often being drawn into protectionist campaigns which treat workers in the third world in particular as enemies rather than allies and so on. What we saw at Seattle was that kind of divide between the other social movements, in particular the movements around the third world and the environment, and organised labour breaking down. A sense developing that the enemy was a common one, that the same global capitalism that was destroying jobs and making working conditions worse in the north was also devastating life in the south as well, and that if we were going to do anything to save decent lives for people around the planet, then we were going to have to unite against that enemy. I think, having said that, that the barriers between the movements and organised labour began to break down at Seattle, I want to make a proviso, which is that this process is a very fragile one. We can see how in the United States the American labour movements are still getting drawn back into the kind of normal electoral process in the United States, lining up, not very happily, but on the whole lining up behind Gore to a large extent. But also the NGOs are subject to the same sorts of problems about incorporation in the existing system that has historically faced the labour movement. I mean, Walden Bellow spoke very well about how the IMF and so on are pursuing strategies that are intended to by presenting a somewhat softer image, integrating at least some of the more supposedly moderate and rational of the NGOs. This is a broader process. If we look at the way in which the greatest military powers in the world, centred on NATO, have adopted the language of humanitarian intervention that was developed by organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières back in the 1980s, we can see the same thing happening very dramatically. A process of incorporation into the imperatives of the dominant power complex. Isn't it striking that NATO's proconsul in Kosovo, where the ethnic cleansing of the Serbs has replaced the ethnic cleansing of the Albanians, is Bernard Kouchner, the founder of Médecins Sans Frontières, one of the authors of the very idea of humanitarian intervention. So a problem that faces both labour unions and NGOs is avoiding the efforts to incorporate them in the agenda of the dominant forces in the world. The seventh thesis I want to put forward is that defending the environment means challenging capitalism. For a long time, the idea was prevalent among many involved in both the Labour and the Green movements that the question of the environment was one that did not reflect the interests, address the interests of all organised labour. Often organised labour was seen as anti-environmental concerns because of its dependence upon polluting manufacturing industry. And at the same time, we saw in the 1980s in the Green Movement a strong pull, very much reflecting what I was talking about a moment ago, towards adopting more realistic, in quotation marks, policies that involved adopting electoral politics, building coalitions with more mainstream parties and the like. We see today the effects of that kind of strategy, with green parties in office in Germany and France that didn't simply participate in NATO's war in the Balkans last year, but also have done nothing effective to challenge the kind of pollution that is constantly taking place, constantly generated by capitalism. But more broadly than that, the fundamental threat to the environment comes from the unrestrained operations of global capitalism on a world scale. If we look at the way in which the major fossil fuel corporations, the oil companies, the automobile corporations and so on and so forth, have built highly effective alliances to campaign against any serious policy for reducing greenhouse emissions, and have done so highly successfully, particularly in the case of the United States, we see how the drive to pollute reflects the imperatives, the priorities of globalized capitalism. To do anything about that, to save the planet, to save the very existence, not just of human life, but the existence of many other species on the planet, requires challenging global capitalism and replacing it with a system based upon a different logic. This then brings me to the eighth thesis I want to put forward, which is that alternative models of society will emerge from the anti-capitalist movement. The most boring thing that happens when you debate what's wrong with global capitalism is someone gets up and says, what's your alternative? Look, the alternative failed in the Soviet Union and indeed in the Czech Republic, so there's no alternative but just to accepting liberal capitalism. It's an incredibly impoverished approach. The idea is that here we are, you know, in the midst of this glorious technological revolution, human powers of invention being demonstrated dramatically every day, but somehow the only choice that we have is between, on the one hand, a very extreme form of deregulated capitalism, of the kind that only really prevails in a few countries like the United States, unfortunately Britain, New Zealand, and so on. That, on the one hand, or the failed, bankrupt Stalinist model, which I would argue represented nothing to do with socialism, a genuine alternative to capitalism in the first place. All the immense diversity of experiment and invention in the socialist movement over the last 200 years since the French Revolution is just knocked aside by this kind of posing of a very stark alternative. I think that out of the out of the anti-capitalist movement is going to come all sorts of different models of an alternative society, all sorts of different conceptions of an alternative society, around which debate will take place, out of which practical political experiments will take place, and through that kind of testing process we'll get a clearer idea and effective working models of what a different kind of society would be like. But we do need a great deal of debate to clarify the nature of these alternative models and to identify their potential eliminations, their potential limitations. And this leads me to the final thesis that I want to put forward, which is that transcending capitalism requires a revolutionary transformation of society. Because I think there's an ambiguity. I started off by talking about the ambiguity of whether we're against globalization or global capitalism. There's also an ambiguity, closely related to it, about whether what we're against is just this particular model of capitalism, the neoliberal model of capitalism, which, as I said, only prevails in quite a limited number of societies on a world scale as it is. Is it that we're against, that particular variant of capitalism, or is it capitalism itself that we're opposed to? And I think that ambiguity came out very well in Walden's speech, when he distinguished between malevolent and benevolent forms of private enterprise. And the impression I got from what he said was that he believes that small-scale, localized forms of capitalism are better than big, multinational forms of capitalism. Well, certainly in my experience in Britain, in many ways the small capitalists are nastier than the big capitalists. The small capitalists pay lower wages, give worse conditions, are less willing to recognise trade unions than the big multinational companies, for a very simple reason. They have less room for manoeuvre. Big companies with their huge funds, their massive profits and so on, can make concessions in a way that small capitalists can't. The only advantage that small capitalists have is that they're weaker than the big ones. But their weakness makes them nasty, whereas the strength, the power of the big ones allows them to pursue strategies of incorporation. I don't think there's much to be gained by trying to kind of weigh the pros and cons of the advantages and disadvantages of these different kinds of capitalism, because common to them all is the logic that I talked about earlier, the logic of competitive accumulation, the logic of exploitation. And it's that logic that is the source of the problem. What we need is to build a society on a fundamentally different logic. The logic not of profit and exploitation, but a logic rather based upon meeting human needs through democratic decision making that takes into account not simply human needs, but the needs of the natural environment in which we live. We need an economic system that meets these two fundamental conditions, that it seeks to address human needs in a sustainable way, and that it is democratically controlled and organized. That fundamentally is what we have to fight for. That kind of system, that kind of alternative social logic, will not be met within the framework of capitalism. If we want to achieve the better, the more humane, the sane, the decent world that I think everyone is fighting for, we need to get rid not just of the particular variant of capitalism that we're confronted with, not particular capitalist institutions, we need to get rid of the very capitalist system itself. And I just want to end on a note of optimism. I think that this is a moment when we can look forward in hope and confidence at our ability to achieve that objective. Certainly in Britain, the 1980s and to a large extent the 1990s were a very dark time of neoliberal dominance, because of course we were the country where the neoliberal experiment was first tried on under Mrs. Thatcher in the 1980s with catastrophic results. for many, many people and many, many aspects of British society. But out of that very dark time, not just in Britain, but I think around the world, we now see a revival of moves of collective resistance that reflects not just desperation, trying to hang on to something against the attacks that are being made, but confidence, a sense that it is possible to roll back the powers of global capitalism. Prague is part of that process. If our protests and arguments and so on are effective over the next few days, we can make a material difference to the speed with which the challenge to global capitalism develops.
That was Professor Alex Kalinikos of the University of York speaking last year in the Czech Republic. Thanks to the Independent Media Center for the previous two tapes. You can access more material from the Independent Media Center on the web at www.indymedia.org. That's IndyMedia.org.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.